today's session, I'm going to be talking about poetry witness, 20th century poetry witness, which is what I worked on as part of my graduate work for 3 years with this poet. And so I got in on the last couple of years of her work on this project, which was about a 10 or 12 year journey, collecting poems that she calls poetry witness. So the poems that I've passed out to you, all but two, come from this book. We'll go through them. But just as a way of introducing poetry witness to those of you who maybe haven't come across that term before, what it is, I guess the way I became interested in it, there's a question asked by a Polish poet named Czesław Miłosz in a poem of his that's called Dedication. And the line reads, "What is poetry which does not save nations or people?" And as some of you may know, there are raging debates about the political and the personal in poetry. And this professor of mine, Carolyn Forché, got embedded in that after she had been in El Salvador in the late 70s, early 80s, and came back and published this book, The Country Between Us, which has a section of political poems. So I'll read a couple of those to you in a few minutes. But she was quite young when she went there, and when she came back and had written these poems about friends and people she had gotten to know in Salvador who disappeared, who were assassinated or in prison. She wrote these poems, came back, and faced a lot of flack for being a young white woman privileged writing on this political subject matter, which was confusing to her. So she started gathering poems by poets in other countries where this did not seem to be such an issue, that there ought to be a division between the political and personal. So that was the beginning of this anthology. And she was collecting photocopies of different poets and finally decided to put it all into a book. So what this book is, and what the reason I became interested in her work, was because I was interested in the power of poetry and art, I guess, for rebellion, to provide hope, to actually cause healing and bring about change. As a teacher of literature right now, I find my students are very resistant to poetry. They don't, unless it's kind of funny and rhymes and they can pin it up on their refrigerator, they don't really see what it has to do with their lives, and they can't make money from it, and they don't see why they have to study it. And in a way, I think this was also her way of saying it can make a huge difference. It can create change in the world. So before we start, just as a writing exercise to loosen you up and maybe bring it home, I want you to free write. I think you've all been in workshops, so you know what free writing is. These workshops I've been in for 2 weeks, you just write without editing yourself or stopping or thinking too hard. Let's see, which one am I going to do? I'd like you to describe an event you can recall from your life where you felt moved, outraged, afraid, heartbroken, etc., due to some sort of injustice or human cruelty. This can be something you observed towards somebody else, that you felt directed towards yourself. Anything, you know, from a playground memory to something you heard on the news, something you read in a book, personal experience, film, whatever. So write it as it comes to you, facts that you recall of it. You know, what was the circumstance, what were the situations, and whatever reactions you remember having to that event. Okay? So, any kind of, where you felt an injustice or unkindness was happening. Thank you. All right, finish up whatever line you're on. All right, before we get into these books and this poetry, if anyone would like to share what you thought of or what you remember or what you recall, we're interested in hearing, but you don't have to. This book ends up being a collection more of events that did not happen in this country. There's a section in it of struggle in the U.S., various struggles, but we have been fortunate, I guess, in this country that most of the battles that happened don't happen in our towns and in our cities, at least on a huge scale. But we certainly have enormous problems of our own right at home. That's another debate that we have. Poetry classes. One poet came in to our school, and Carolyn works pretty hard on this subject matter, and said, you know, why spend so much time with what happens in other countries when there's so much trouble here? And that's true. Just one reason I was interested in what you remembered or experienced.
I don't think this is particularly beautiful, but I was moved by Scott's sermon the other day about the cellist who played in Sarajevo, and that's what came to mind.
Okay.
And I have one image in here that I like that may sometime go somewhere, but I started, in our newspaper I read how they killed each other, these people with boundaries, mothers in red lines waiting for food, men in their tanks leveled with guns, how 22 women died. And then how the most famous national cellist of the Sarajevo Symphony came each day to that spot, lifted a bow, and played in the sign of a cross. 22 days in a row, a dirge of such beauty, tears creasing his face, the firing crashing in the background like obscene cymbals, truly the backup music from hell. The part I like that suddenly moved me was the image of the cellist who plays with the across a piece of wood like this. And the, until I was writing it, I thought of that cross image of
Running. Well, and that too, as an act of resistance, you know, an artistic act of resistance in the face of your own danger or the hopelessness of the situation is what's so amazing, I think. The work in this book is devastating. teaching about it is quite devastating, but also what creates the hope is that there are these people in the world resisting, whether it's in terms of writing or being part of an underground movement or speaking or playing instruments, or that, you know, a solitary act like that is really moving in the face of the events of this century. So
I have one very short, but this one is about a little girl that was, since she's now going into seventh grade, and she's been begging me to be her mother. Mm-hmm. Her mother is Winnebago Indian, her father is a black man out of Chicago. And she's at our school, which is an Indian school. Black face, red crowd. I am a Winnebago Indian. I am a Winnebago Indian. I know my hair is too black. I know my hair is too curly. Lana says I have stink feet. Lana says I smell. I am a Winnebago Indian. Lana says my skin is too black. Lana says my nose is large. Please, I am a Winnebago Indian. You know, because we think of pushing out certain people. Mm-hmm. And all, you know, we all tend to do it.
Yeah.
And this little girl, they don't run around because they call our names and so on. And Lana, this little girl, is very bright, Camille is. But she doesn't fit where she's at all.
Yeah. So your writing right there ends up being an act of witness, what you have seen and what you have experienced, and putting it into words.
Yeah, that's it. I couldn't tell you why, but your request triggered an image from 40 years ago. John staged the new models under the edge of a sand cliff, gathering a handful of stones that he had collected and used many times. He walked away about a dozen paces, sharing his bombs with the other children, most of whom could not afford models, and I was one such boy. He exhorted us to destroy what we could not buy. The stones flew, the plastic shrapnel scattered in all directions. Decals lay limp and torn on the ground.
Beautiful. And something you haven't thought of.
I haven't thought of that in decades. But there was the material, or the warlike models that he bought.
Yeah.
We couldn't afford, and then wantonly destroy them right in front of us. Mm-hmm. And then get us to participate in that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Alright. Anyone else?
A lot of images came to me. It was through this area that image came to me first too. And I'm wanting to do something for that image as well. You've given me some more ideas.
I think that's one of the things I love about art, that I think it grows. You know, you hear a song or you see a photograph or you listen to a poem and it will spur another manifestation of it somewhere else.
And certainly it's got them in other people's witness. It is paper articles or poems that I have then used to create the songs. So yeah, that's true.
Well, I had read that newspaper article on my own back from Minnesota, but I had forgotten it until Scott used to be the circle. And I remembered that I sat there and I read it with tears going down my face.
The one that came to me this time was an image that I believe was truly a turning point in my life. I had known and loved the story of the little metro. And when I was about 12, our family, I was a military family, lived in Turkey, and commuted. We lived in town, and then the base was a distance away, and so the school bus took us across this main city bridge through the town every day. And I was already aware that there were beggars that came to our door in town. We lived in a fairly safe neighborhood, but other neighborhoods I knew I couldn't go without having rocks thrown at me. Didn't really have a lot of understanding, but I was beginning to understand there was a very big difference between us and a lot of the Turkish kids that I saw around me. And it had never come home as clearly as one bitterly cold November day when the bus was traveling its road across this huge city bridge. And on the right, there was a beggar child dressed in a very thin black dress. And she was sitting on the bridge, crouched over, clearly very cold, with her hand out, just like this. And it was a mental picture that sunk into my brain that I will never forget, and made me aware this was not just, there's something very wrong here. Mm-hmm.
That reminds me of one of the images of one of the poems I read in a reading last night. It was a man in Bombay. That's the same kind of image where we were on the bus, and these throngs of people in the streets, just moving mass of activity. But I saw just for a second as the bus passed this man walking along in this, you know, white t-shirt, but it was so threadbare and ripped and tattered. I mean, really, it was no longer a shirt. And he had been holding it together, little pins, little pieces of wire, little pieces of string. So it was like a lace or a crochet. You know, it was this bizarre shirt and image in my mind of this very beautiful thing, but out of wounds, you know. And that was, like you say, just a memory and an image that never be rid of, and it was a flash, you know, just a second. You see that and think about what it means. Well, right. Well, thank you for that. I want to talk a little bit about this book and what is in it. And if you're interested in witness and in the events of the 20th, it's just 20th century, but more than enough, yes, for kind of events that it's cataloging.
Is this in the bookstore?
I didn't order it because it's a $20 book, and I didn't know whether they could move something like that, and I wasn't going to use it as a text for 2 weeks. But it was just published in April, and I have seen it at least in Minnesota in almost every bookstore I've gone into. So according to Carolyn, it's selling pretty well, so I think it ought to be around for a while. What I wanted to talk about briefly was the idea of a poem as a testimony of a lived life. And part of the argument about political versus personal poetry has to do with, you know, the thought from way, way back. I think Horace had prescribed for poetry a language of the sweet and the useful. It was supposed to be uplifting. It was supposed to move us to happiness and positive feeling. Obviously, if poems are testimony of lived life, and the lived life of so many in this century have been devastating experiences, the language has to adapt to that. And as we were choosing poets to include in here, and works to include, the styles were vastly different, the experience had been incredibly different, but the one thing that seems to tie the poems together is a kind of fragmentation or rupture in consciousness and therefore language. They're not narrative in the sense of even Carolyn's writing. In this book, which was so popular, where she writes narrative, but I'll read a couple, but from her experience in Salvador. After that time, she spent time in Beirut and South Africa, among other places, and didn't write. She hasn't written a book of her own poetry in 10 years, because what was coming out were these fragments, little images, little blurts of scenes and of thought. And she was despairing of never being able to write poetry again, but realized after about 10 years of collecting and continuing to write this, that what had happened was her work had changed shape. She was no longer writing narrative stories of experience, but she was sort of collecting these fragments of different countries, different voices, different experiences, different things she'd seen, and that her style had to change in order to adapt to this. And that became one of the features of this book. What happens to the mind of someone who has suffered a prison camp and is trying to articulate through writing or through language something that can't really be articulated? You haven't been there. How can you speak of it? So, let's see, I'll try to do this in order. I'll backtrack a little and I'm going to read a couple of poems from her book, because that's, for me, as a person who didn't even write much poetry, I've written all my life in journals, but I wouldn't have called them poems, I guess. But in college I read this book and it changed me completely. The Country Between Us is what it's called, by Carolyn Forché. I think because it was poetry of witness, and it seemed responsible writing to me. It was somebody recording or writing about something that they had seen, and not appropriating it as though this was my experience, or here, listen to what I have to say about it, but simply reporting what she had seen.
How do you spell her last name?
It's F-O-R-C-H-E. It's French. Accent over the E. Forché. So, quickly I will read of these. The first one is called The Visitor. She wrote it in 1979. In Spanish, he whispers, there is no time left. It is the sound of scythes arcing in wheat, the ache of some field song in Salvador. The wind along the prison, cautious as Francisco's hands on the inside, touching the walls as he walks. It is his wife's breath, slipping into his cell each night while he imagines his hand to be hers. It is a small country. There is nothing one man will not do to another. That she wrote after being taken secretly in the night to prison in Salvador. For 5 minutes, she had 5 minutes to go in and was absolutely overcome by this. The tiny cells where people squatted, and the smell, and the fact that they had been kept there for years. This other is also based on a true event. It's called The Colonel, and it's probably became her most well-known and most anthologized poem. It's a prose poem. And the language, if you listen to it, the sentences are not really staccato, but they're just statements, one after the other. Almost, it's very emotional, but there's not a lot of emotion. Let me decide and listen. It's more of a recording of events. The kernel. What you have heard is true. I was in his house. His wife carried a tray of coffee and sugar. His daughter filed her nails. His son went out for the night. There were daily papers, pet dogs, a pistol on the cushion beside him. The moon swung bare on its black cord over the house. On the television was a cop show. It was in English. Broken bottles were embedded in the walls around the house to scoop the kneecaps from a man's legs or cut his hands to lace. On the windows there were gratings like those in liquor stores. We had dinner, rack of lamb, good wine. A bell was on the table for calling the maid. The maid brought green mangoes, salt, a type of bread. I was asked how I enjoyed the country. There was a brief commercial in Spanish. His wife took everything away. There was some talk then of how difficult it had become to govern. The parrot said hello on the terrace. The colonel told it to shut up and pushed himself from the table. My friend said to me with his eyes, "Say nothing." The colonel returned with a sack used to bring groceries home. He spilled many human ears on the table. They were like dried peach halves. There is no other way to say this. He took one of them in his hands, shook it in our faces, dropped it into a water glass. It came alive there. "I am tired of fooling around," he said. "As for the rights of anyone, tell your people they can go fuck themselves." He swept the ears to the floor with his arm and held the last of his wine in the air. "Something for your poetry, no?" he said. Some of the ears on the floor caught this scrap of his voice. Some of the ears on the floor were pressed to the ground. That was May 1978. Anyway, it was experiences like that which caused her, as a newly graduate student writing poetry, to come back and become concerned about reporting to the rest of the world about events. So, what I'd like to do now is go through some of these poems I photocopied for you from this book and talk about them in terms of either their subject matter, fragmentation maybe of the language or how they are presented. Some of them are surreal because surrealism and fragmentation became, at least for, I guess, maybe particularly for survivors of the show at the concentration camps, as they tried to talk about what had happened to them, their stories fractured. And well, we'll go through a few of these so you can see in the poems. Let me start with the yellow star that goes with me, which is not, I don't know who Jessica Greenbaum is. She's not in this anthology. I took this out of the New Yorker magazine because it seemed to be a lot of what I was studying and what we were doing with this book. She may or may not be someone that has actual experience with prison camps. But I'll read it. The yellow star that goes with me, which is the Star of David that the Jews were forced to wear. Sometimes when I'm really thirsty, I mean really dying of thirst, for 5 minutes. Sometimes when I board a train. Sometimes in December when I'm absolutely freezing. For 5 minutes. Sometimes when I take a shower. Sometimes in December when I'm absolutely freezing. Sometimes when I reach from steam to towel, when the bed has soft blue sheets. Sometimes when I take a shower. For 20 minutes, the white tiles dripping with water. Sometimes when I reach from steam to towel, when the bed has soft blue sheets. Sometimes when I split an apple, or when I'm hungry, painfully hungry. For 20 minutes, the white tiles dripping with water. As the train passes Chambers Street, we're all crammed in like laundry. Sometimes when I split an apple, or when I'm hungry, painfully hungry. For half an hour, sometimes when I'm on a train. as it passes Chambers Street. We're all crammed in like laundry. It's August. The only thing to breathe is everybody's stains for half an hour. Sometimes when I'm on a train or just stand along the empty platform. It's August. The only thing to breathe is everybody's stains. Sometimes when I board a train or just stand along the empty platform. Sometimes when I'm thirsty, I mean really dying of thirst. This form is called a pantoum. It was Malaysian, but the Europeans confiscated it. And there is a pattern to which lines repeat. But it seemed to me the perfect form for this kind of memory or reporting of events. That if you had been in a concentration camp, something like being on a train, time itself, this repetition of for 5 minutes, for 20 minutes, you know, what time would mean to you as a prisoner? Either in terms of moving fast, if you're waiting for an execution or the execution of a friend, or in terms of, you know, an entire life or 18 years or what you're going to spend in prison. But how people who survive what Carolyn calls conditions of extremity, which means imprisonment, exile from your country and having to take on another country or another language, someone who has fought in any of the armies, been on the front, what happens to your way of thinking or how you can live the rest of your life after you have suffered these sorts of conditions. This seemed to me a form for poetry, utterly in sync with the fragmentation of one's experience or how you've been able to write about it. But like I said, this is not an anthology, and I don't know this person's experience or whether it's someone who's related to someone who survived. I'll go on. Let's do what happened.
Is this what you're talking about, fragmentation?
This is one kind of fragmentation. There are a lot of different kinds. In fact, why don't I just read one to you out of the book that I didn't copy for you. This one is about, it's called Vocabulary, by a poet named Ariel Dorfman, who's a Chilean poet. And it is about trying to tell a story when you don't have the language for it. It's called Vocabulary. But how can I tell their story if I was not there? When two of them met far away on an unfamiliar street corner, they could not know if it was a first meeting or a farewell. They could not know who was looking at them from the quadrangle of that window, reporting every movement of their lips. I was looking at them from another country, and I cannot tell their story. I was calling from another country, and the phone was always busy. Show me a word I can use. Show me one verb, an adjective as clear as a ray of light. Listen carefully to the bottom of every sentence, to the attic and the dust in the furniture of every sentence. Perk up your ears. Listen and look under the bed of every sentence, at the soldiers waiting their turn at the foot of the bride's bed. To preserve just one word, what is it to be? Like a question on a quiz show. If you could take one word with you to the future, what is it to be? Find it. Plunge into the garbage heap. Stick your hands deep into the ooze. Close your fist around the fragment of a mirror fractured by feet that dance on what should have been a wedding night. Let me tell you something. Even if I had been there, I could not have told their story. I was calling from another country, and the phone was still busy. I was trying to call home, and the machine had just swallowed my last dime. As for the story, I cannot tell. They accumulated tenderness, as others accumulate money. Ask them, even if the phone is busy, even if the machine has just swallowed your last dime, even if the operator drowns out all the other voices, ask them for the verse our lovers will still need, if we are ever again to bathe in the same river. Let them speak for themselves. It's another kind of fragmentation of questioning. Someone who actually did experience, but is recognizing all the experiences that were not experienced by himself. And who's going to speak it, especially in the situations of people who were destroyed. This poetry in this anthology, Carolyn treats as trace and evidence of events that happened even when the people didn't survive. One of the poets in here is named Miklos Radnoti, and he was someone who went on a forced march and was writing, recording in a notebook through all of it, and was executed with the other people on the march. But after liberation, his wife went and found the mass grave and dug up his body and went into the coat of his pocket and found this book with these poems.
Wow.
That record evidence of the march, a friend being shot. You know, it's true. It's proof and it's trace of events that happened that the people didn't necessarily survive to tell. And part of its importance, obviously, for us is in instruction and paying attention to what happens and not having the arrogance to assume this can't happen again. And on that note, look at what happens at home that you've got in the packet. There are a couple of these to look at. What happens? On the back of it is questions about poetry since Auschwitz. But it either comes at two sides, it's like you can't find it. Right, what happens? It has happened, and it goes on happening, and will happen again if nothing happens to stop it. The innocent know nothing because they are too innocent, and the guilty know nothing because they are too guilty. The poor do not notice because they are too poor, and the rich do not notice because they are too rich. The stupid shrug their shoulders because they are too stupid, and the clever shrug their shoulders because they are too clever. The young do not care because they are too young, and the old do not care because they are too old. That is why nothing happens to stop it, and that is why it has happened and goes on happening and will happen again. This is, let's see if I can keep them straight, got notes to myself. Thais, and I don't pronounce any of these names correctly. He is Polish. When the Germans invaded Poland, he went underground. And his experience, and continued to write poetry. A lot of this, it was hard to find translations, the people who were translating this, because most of these poems weren't in English. A translation is a tricky act in itself, what you finally get in your language that you understand. So that became another whole angle to this poetry of language and how to pass it on. We'll do another one that's similar to this. Any Case, which is a woman, Wisława Szymborska. Remind myself of her background. I worked for 3 years collecting these, and you'd think I'd know them better, but they all started to become very confusing to me on their names and where they were from and their exact experience. She is also Polish. Yeah. Any case. It could have happened. It had to happen. It happened earlier, later, closer, farther away. It happened, but not to you. You survived because you were the first. You survived because you were the last, because alone, because the others, because on the left, because on the right, because it was raining, because it was sunny, because a shadow fell. Luckily, there was a forest. Luckily, there were no trees. Luckily, a rail, a hook, a beam, a break, a frame, a turn, an inch, a second. Luckily, straw was floating on the water. Thanks to, thus, in spite of, and yet. What would have happened if a hand, a leg, one step, a hair away? So you are here, straight from that moment, still suspended. The net's mesh was tight, but you, through the mesh? I can't stop wondering at it, can't be silent enough. Listen, how quickly your heart is beating in me. This is another fragment of many, many, many experiences. You know, why somebody survived, why someone in the ranks escaped or got shot or didn't get shot or was chosen last or chosen first, and all of these events. Let's see.
Can I ask you a question in comparison to the last two, the what happened and then anyway? How come I'm new to poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy it, but I haven't had much experience. But in what happens,
Why don't we have a comma or a period or anything, and then it may be...
Okay. There are. There's punctuation. What ideas, what do you think, when you look at what happens, and there's no punctuation in that? Any ideas about that? Particularly the ending.
Mm-hmm.
And goes on happening and will happen again, left suspended.
Mm-hmm.
And you will find in this anthology, although there are a lot of different forms, quite a lot of the poems do not use punctuation or don't use what we consider regular punctuation. Either because it's a run-on, there's a kind of breathless sense to some of them, that it has to be told quickly and it has to be gotten out. In fact, a very short one that ends like that, I wonder if I can find it in here, written by Paul Celan. This is Pegasus. Okay. She writes, this is in her introduction. Dan Pegasus' native language was German. Pegasus spent 3 years in a concentration camp and immigrated to Israel, where he became a leading Hebrew poet. His Hebrew was the result of history, of displacement. It was the very mark of his exile, a notion that is given great poignancy in his little graffiti poem called Written in Pencil in a Sealed Boxcar. That's the title.
Wow.
And it's very short, and it's intended to be thought of as graffiti, you know, found on the wall. Here in this carload, I am Eve, and Abel my son. If you see my other son, Cain, son of man, tell him that I... And that's how it ends. The implication being the person never got to finish the poem. So the form of these poems become part of the testimony of what happened, what didn't happen, what was finished, what wasn't finished. So that's, in terms of fragmentation or surreal imagery, a lot of what goes on in these. So a lot of it has to do with an individual poet, you know, your own style. When you write, it's often a mystery why you put punctuation or why you break a line there or why you start a new stanza. In analyzing poems, it may or may not be useful to note the poet's sensibility. It helps often to read more than one of their poems, so that you have a sense of their style. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes, it does.
Let's look at On Living, because this is a longish poem, but I used it in another of the workshops where we were talking about praise and celebration, because I think this is a poem of praise and celebration. But the debate came up about, especially in terms of our Christian beliefs or the sacred, there are some interesting questions that come up in this poem on living. Living is no laughing matter. You must live with great seriousness, like a squirrel, for example. I mean, without looking for something beyond and above living. I mean, living must be your whole occupation. Living is no laughing matter. You must take it seriously, so much so and to such a degree that, for example, your hands tied behind your back, your back to the wall, or else in the laboratory, in your white coat and safety glasses, you can die for people, even for people whose faces you've never seen, even though you know living is the most real, the most beautiful thing. I mean, you must take living so seriously that even at 70, for example, you'll plant olive trees, and not for your children either, but because although you fear death, you don't believe it. Because living, I mean, weighs heavier. Let's say we're seriously ill, need surgery, which is to say we might not get up from the white table. Even though it's impossible not to feel sad about going a little too soon, we'll still laugh at the jokes being told. We'll look out the window to see if it's raining, or still wait anxiously for the latest newscast. Let's say we're at the front, for something worth fighting for, say. There, in the first offensive on that very day, we might fall on our face dead. We'll know this with a curious anger, but we'll still worry ourselves to death about the outcome of the war which could last years. Let's say we're in prison, and close to 50, and we have 18 more years, say, before the iron doors will open. We'll still live with the outside, with its people and animals, struggle and wind. I mean with the outside beyond the walls. I mean, however and wherever we are, We must live as if we will never die. This earth will grow cold, a star among stars, and one of the smallest, a gilded mote on blue velvet. I mean this, our great earth. This earth will grow cold one day, not like a block of ice, or a dead cloud even, but like an empty walnut, it will roll along in pitch black space. You must breathe for this right now. You have to feel this sorrow now, for the world must be loved this much if you're going to say, I lived.
Mm-hmm. And what nationality is he?
He's Turkish. And he spent 18 years in prison. And wrote many love poems and many poems of resistance from prison. And he's an interesting poet because his work spans a spectrum of devastated and depressed and angry and violent writing to the most tender and passionate and hopeful and beautiful writing, which occurs over and over and over again. Poets in this book is one of the reasons it's so powerful. It shows us both the despair and the strength of the human spirit in coping conditions of extremity. But we discussed this a little bit in terms of, you know, celebration. Is it celebration, and what is it celebrating, and how does it celebrate? And what a difference this poem is than St. Mary Oliver, who's a contemporary American poet who's writing very much about the natural world, the beauty of trees and lightning, and her celebrations are more comforting and in a lot of ways more easily accessible. But no less true, you know, to one, what one's experience is. How does one celebrate the world when you're in prison for 18 years and watching your life go by? Do we have time for
No, what's interesting to me is that it's written in 1948, mm-hmm. and how incredibly contemporary this whole image of the earth growing cold mm-hmm. one day. The thing that's in the library right now, Tom, or in the bookstore, the Tom Berry on creation, or the creation story of the universe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this anticipation of a time of ruins. Mm-hmm. Isn't that very sobering?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that taking care of the world, and we didn't hear that in 1948
right.
at all.
And this mm-hmm. is an ecological poem. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, let's look at another one of his that I gave you, is Things I Didn't Know I Loved. And that's a three-pager, and you can read that on your own, but I suggest you do because it's also a celebration poem. And very beautiful, but it's long. Look at the God of War, Bertolt Brecht. This one I find interesting. I saw the old God of War stand in a bog between chasm and rock face. He smelled of free beer and carbolic and showed his testicles to adolescents, for he had been rejuvenated by several professors. In a hoarse, wolfish voice, he declared his love for everything young. Nearby stood a pregnant woman, trembling. And without shame, he talked on and presented himself as a great one for order. And he described how everywhere he put barns in order by emptying them. And as one throws crumbs to sparrows, he fed poor people with crusts of bread, which he had taken away from poor people. His voice was now loud, now soft, but always hoarse. In a loud voice, he spoke of great times to come. And in a soft voice, he taught the women how to cook crows and seagulls. Meanwhile, his back was unquiet, and he kept looking round as though afraid of being stabbed. And every 5 minutes, he assured his public that he would take up very little of their time.
Wow.
This, too, uses a different kind of fragmentation, kind of surreal images that speak to the events of the time. It is a warning poem. We put that one over. I think we can do one more. Sorry that we don't have more time. This one, Children of the Epoch. You have that? We are children of the epoch. The epoch is political. All my daily and nightly affairs, all your daily and nightly affairs are political affairs. Whether you want it or not, your genes have a political past, your skin a political tone, your eyes a political color. What you say resounds. What you don't say is also politically significant. Even coming through the rye, you walk with political steps on political ground. Apolitical poems are also political, and in the sky there's a moon that's no longer moon-like. To be or not to be, that is a question. Oh, darling, what a question. Give a suggestion, a political question. You don't have to be human to acquire a political meaning. It's enough to be petroleum, cattle fodder, raw material, or just a conference table whose shape was disputed for months. In the meantime, people were killed. Animals died, houses burned, fields grew wild, as in distant and less political epochs. So many of these poems, I think, are a call to action, a call to other artists, other people, to pay attention, to write, to sing, to paint, to speak out about what has happened, about what continues to happen. It's grim work in a way, and it's also, like I said, the most beautiful and hopeful and positive of the work. It was a devastating project, I will confess, to work on these poems and to try to choose and to try to determine who to include in the anthology. Finally, what Carolyn decided was to include only people whose works in poetry in their country turned out to be recognized on some level. There were many, 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 many people writing. Unfortunately, fewer women translated, so there are more men in this anthology. But I'm hoping to teach it and to teach the importance of this kind of poetry. And also there are enormous debates about these poems that we've just read. Are they political? Are they personal? Is there any way to separate those two things? But I should quit talking and give you a couple minutes. We're sort of out of time, but if you have any questions or any comments to make about any of these, I hope you'll read the ones to yourselves that we didn't get to.
You said that children or the young people you taught didn't vibe on this. They wanted the more pleasant stuff. Are you making breakthrough? You know, this is...
Well, I haven't taught this. This book just came out, and I would love to teach a class, you know, using this as the textbook, because I do think, I have found that students are quite hungry for poetry and for art. They just don't, they have read maybe Robert Frost or Shakespeare, or, and they've been told that this is how to translate it, and this is what the poem means, and have been kind of stifled. I sense that a lot of times when they read it or come up with their interpretation, they go, oh no, that's wrong, this is what the poem means, and they lose hope in being able to understand poetry. Or they simply haven't been reading the spectrum of what's out there. You know, we have been taught so often in our English classes white male poets rather than poets of color, women, poets from other countries, other sensibilities, and I think that in fact there will be enormous hunger and need for this kind of work. And I don't mean to say that I don't think students are interested in it. I think they haven't been exposed to it. So my hope is that this book will be a big seller on the way. Not because of money. I think she gets about 50 cents per book that sells. So, you know, poetry continues not to be a way to make any kind of financial living, but very, very important. So.
I know.
Anything else?
Maybe some of writing that more or less I've done are people that have worked with Native American issues.
Mm-hmm.
Helps more or less the public be aware.
Yes.
Of both injustice or problems going on within the Native American community or community at large.
Well, the writing you showed me, your own writing, you know, it's witness, it's poetry, yeah. Witness. It's exactly
yeah,
what
witness
it is.
And, mm-hmm. Self-reflection, too.
Yeah. Important work. Utterly
the thing I like about it, I think I'm right. When you write a poem like this, or when it's out there, you know, when it leaves you, either at a reading or by the published or by it being handed around the table, in a way, it's not an argument. It doesn't create defensiveness in the same way that it might if we tried to talk about an issue that was very difficult and everybody had their vested interests in it, where we clash and we don't hear one another. I mean, we may not agree with the poem in it. That happens. But we have to take the time to get through it, to find out what is there before we argue with it.
And it is its artifact. You know, it is its testimony to somebody's life and experience, no matter what. You know, not just this subject matter, but...